The following podcast is broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
This is Tasman Report with news, feature interviews and voices shaping Aorere. I'm John Bullock and this show is a production of the Tasman District Council. Coming up, how good can it get with a spatial plan? What do international figures really tell us about disaster preparedness? And we visit the Moutrie and the Old House Road Weir. Spinning out of the RMA reform is a requirement from the Natural Built Environment Act and the Spatial Planning Act for regions to develop regional spatial plans. So what does this mean for Tasman? Barry Johnson, our Environmental Policy Manager, picks up the story.
It's a 30-year strategy that plots out the future for Tasman, the opportunities, the constraints. It does cover growth and the balance between the urban and rural environments. Things like tourism, where are opportunities for economic growth, but also where are our constraints? Where are the places that we don't want to build or put people in harm's way or put new industries in harm's way? So it is very much a future-focused strategy that plots out the future for Tasman.
It doesn't alter, like, for example, the long-term plan or the TRMP, Tasman Resource Management Plan, does it? Because they're more, how would you describe those guys, tactical management?
It influences them. So the regional spatial plan is an umbrella strategy that overarches all those other plans. So it will influence the long-term plan. So the investment decisions through the long-term plan will have to reflect the direction of the regional spatial strategy. The replacement TRMP will also have to implement the regional spatial strategy. So the strategy itself doesn't have any teeth, so to speak. It is implemented through other documents. So all the rules and things sit underneath it.
So with the plan, there's a couple of options that people are looking at, and that is either Tasman develops their own or we go together with Nelson. I won't ask you where the feeling is at the moment because people are sort of making up their minds, but there's kind of like pros and cons for both, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. The pros are we get a plan that looks across the region that reflects probably our socioeconomic, our economic drivers, our tourism drivers and things. Tasman only, it's probably quicker, faster, cheaper. But again, it doesn't reflect that interconnectedness between both Tasman and Nelson. So you could have a bob each way, and certainly the jury's out.
So decisions on this, is it very far out?
It'll depend on what the legislation says ultimately. The planning bill and environment bill have to be passed into law. The select committee is sending their report back to Parliament at the end of June. We'll have a bit more clarity on what that means. And ultimately, following that, the national direction, which gives us a real detail on what needs to go into the spatial plan, will come out in early 27. So it may not be until early 2027 that we really know for sure which way we go.
For folks who are concerned about whether we have that kind of connected up infrastructure, it appears as though something like a spatial plan is going to help with that.
We would expect so. A lot of infrastructure is linear, so it traverses urban rural boundaries. It goes across districts, across regions. And so planning for infrastructure, for example, makes sense at a broader scale, at a regional scale or multi-regional scale. There are real benefits in that.
And when now we're having to look out 30 years and do that with a sort of like trying to get the ink dry on those ideas because we've got climate change to consider, this is a good place for the spatial plan.
Yeah, it is. And the spatial plan has a requirement to identify areas for climate change adaptation. So we know there are areas in Tasman that are prone to climate change, and the regional spatial plan will identify those and prioritise those for adaptation planning. And that will be the trigger to trigger a process that will occur under the Climate Change Response Act, where we work with our communities to plan for their futures.
And finally, this must be working on environmental policy. I imagine this is really exciting stuff because we're looking at the future and we've got a whole lot of new tools coming on like AI.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's very future focused and it's quite exciting to have new legislation after 30 years. It's going to be real transformational time and a really exciting time to be in this space.
Talking about the potential that a regional spatial plan could have for Tasman, that was Environmental Policy Manager Barry Johnson. At the 21 May Strategy, Finance and Performance Committee, a Motueka Master Plan update and proposed community engagement plan prompted this question.
Right, Councillor Killamont.
Thank you through the chair. Yes, I've got a question here this time. We've got the Motueka Master Plan. We've got the Mapua Master Plan. In the middle is a little village called Tasman. What's going to happen with them? Because there's been talk about growing Tasman, doing all sorts of things. They've got issues with wastewater and water already. I would have thought that you've got a little slither of land and people there that have missed out on the master plan either side. So is there, what's the reason for not including Tasman Village in it?
Through the chair, just to clarify, in terms of this resolution, the approach will be that essentially there will be no further discussion around a Motueka master plan because it will be discussed through regional spatial planning and adaptation planning processes. So Tasman Village will be able to be considered as part of that wider regional spatial planning process as well.
Team Leader for Natural Resources, Diana Worthy, joins us to run through the scope of the Motueka Master Plan update and the proposed Community Engagement Plan.
So before we make any long-term planning decisions, we want to take the time to listen to the community, share information and build a common picture of Motueka's opportunities and challenges. So in 2026, the focus will be on our shared past and our shared present. And so this will help prepare for future conversations about our shared future. And so we're doing this because Motueka is facing some important issues, including growth, natural hazards and a changing climate, infrastructure pressures, and protecting productive land. And we know that these are big topics, and it's important for the Motueka ward community has a chance to understand them and to be part of the conversation. So rather than continuing with a separate Motueka master plan, Council's proposing to bring that work into future planning processes that will be required under the new planning legislation. And so we'll be kicking off with developing a regional spatial plan next year. So at its heart, this engagement work is about connecting with the people, hearing local experiences, and helping the Motueka ward community feel informed and ready to take part in shaping Motueka's future.
Team Leader for Natural Resources, Diana Worthy. It might be a small weir on a rural stream on Old House Road in the Moutree catchment, but it's a weir with a big story. Built in the 1960s, over time, it became a barrier blocking native fish from upstream habitat, also starting to fail structurally. Tim O'Connell spoke with Trevor James, Principal Scientist, Freshwater and Estuarine Ecology, about the ingenuity that has created a win for nature and users.
There's this structure right across the stream in the Moutree River has been quite a thorn in my side as an aquatic ecologist for a long time, since 2006 when I first came across it, because of the magnitude of effects in terms of preventing fish migration upstream to quite a large catchment. It's nearly 5,000 hectares upstream, about 28 kilometres of permanently flowing stream. There's also intermittently flowing stream length on top of that that's of high value to our whole stream ecology. So it is quite significant from that point of view. Not all species are prevented from getting upstream here, but it's Inaya, common smelt, and some of our bullies. Eels are very good at climbing around these structures. They'll get up through the long grass and so forth. But these other species, they just can't get up a massive cascade over large boulders like this weir presented.
What was the thinking and the approach in terms of how you were going to move forward to work on the weir?
Well, maybe we step back a little bit. I first saw this weir when I flew over it with Fish and Game, doing some game bird counts on ponds around the Moutree and looked down into the Moutree River. And it really stood out to me as a very significant potential barrier to fish passage. And so that was in 2006. It took us a while to get some funds together and it's Project Green back in the day, or
Task Force Green,
that's right, thank you, that had some funding. We had some labour, and I got some funding for a concrete, and we built a concrete ramp on top of the large boulders that from the crest of the weir down to the pool at the bottom. And so that worked well for a couple of years. So that was from 2010 to 2012. And then after that, a series of floods caused degradation of the bed. So the bed level dropped on the downstream side of the weir. And it then my lovely concrete ramp became perched, and again the fish couldn't get up. So we then thought, oh well, another cheap fix, put a little rubber ramp attached by concrete screws and what have you. But because of the high velocities in this part of the Moochoo River, it just would have flapped itself to like crazy, and it would have come off. So it was back to the drawing board once again. And that brought us to the 2021 or so, when some funding became available through our River Engineering Works to address this issue, which the structure is an orphan site. It was constructed, as said in the introduction, by the Ministry of Works, and then basically abandoned. And this is now an orphan structure. Council's taken on the responsibility for it because of its responsibilities under the Resource Management Act to provide for ecosystem health, and so we set about dealing with this. So we needed a new way of managing this, and one of the biggest things was to stabilise the bed, particularly that downstream, stop it downcutting anymore. So a series of weirs were put in downstream. Now, these were called void fill riprap engineered aggregate, and so it's a relatively new technique, but they've worked very, very well and stood the test of those big floods in July last year. The idea with these is that they create really natural looking streams. You would, by going there, you would not know that this material is engineered and what have you. This was not outflanked, so it was it all stood up really well, and fish are using it as habitat, which is great, and it's all in accordance with the New Zealand Fish Passage guidelines. So that has meant that the bed level was raised, and so the drop from the top of the weir down to the bottom was much less. It wasn't quite finished before the July floods of last year, and then those floods came along, and then because of the size of these floods, they just went so wide, there were such high velocities that they outflanked the original weir. Now, this erosion, I'm told from our river engineers and fluvial geomorphologists, would have happened regardless of any of the weirs that were constructed downstream, just because of the magnitude of this flood, and it just went ripped out wide of the existing structure and then undermined a pump station and other infrastructure. So yeah, it's very, very hard to, in my mind, to see how it would have caused any issues, because it was many tens of meters downstream.
Trevor, projects of this magnitude often benefit from additional help where they can. Was this the case with the Moultrie Weir?
Yes, we went through looking at all the different options, and we got professional advice from ecological engineers, from traditional river engineers. And the options on the table were some really large, straight and very engineered structures that wouldn't have provided so much fish habitat and worked so well from an ecological point of view. We ended up with an ecological engineer who blended those real knowledge of streams and how the shear forces and everything work to potentially undermine the integrity of any new structures that were put in. So that knowledge has obviously paid off to have commissioned that ecological engineer, because those weirs that were built by that engineer have stayed and after some of the largest floods on record. So that is a real positive thing. And all of this was well considered through the resource consent process.
There must be a sense of contentment as to where we are now with the program.
Absolutely. Well, the contentment for me comes from seeing schools of Inanga upstream of this weir. For the first time, we are recording hundreds of schools in their hundreds and all the way up to Upper Moutere, up past Supplejack Valley Road, which is quite a few kilometres upstream, and other tributaries of the Moutere River. So that really warms my heart that we have been successful. Now, I haven't got quantitative data on the absolute numbers that are getting over this and whether some of the Inanga are still struggling, but we are intending to collect that data this coming summer. We just had other priorities last summer. But yeah, that is what we aimed to do from the start, is to get these fish populations upstream. And that has flow-on effects for the aquatic ecology. Everybody loves birds in their garden, like the koltare, the kingfisher. They'll be feeding on these Inanga, and many other birds will as well. So people will hopefully come to appreciate this in many more ways than just knowing that the fish are there upstream of the weir.
Tim O'Connell spoke with Trevor James, Principal Scientist, Freshwater and Estuarine Ecology, about the Moutere Old House Road weir. What to make of reported statistics that have New Zealand in the top 10 for disasters, while at the same time in the top 10 for coping, and ninth out of 177 countries for impact from natural disasters? I put it to Barbara Luendo, our Senior Climate Change Policy Advisor, this question. How can we live in what appears to be multiple data realities? I mean, can they all be true at the same time?
Yes, I think they do. And I think that is exactly New Zealand reality. We are highly exposed to natural hazards because of our geography and because of where many communities are located, near the coast, near our rivers, and the vulnerable infrastructure that we have. Climate change is increasing that pressure through flooding, sea level rise, storms, drought, and flood and wildfire risk. But exposure to risk does not mean that we are unprepared. New Zealand is also recognized for strong communities, practical emergency management responses, good science, and the ability to recover and adapt. So both things can absolutely be true. We face increasing climate risk, like you said, and we are comparatively strong at coping with them. The challenge now, though, is making sure that our preparedness keeps pace with the scale of change, which is really fast moving. For Tasman, that means planning ahead carefully so residents and our ratepayers can have confidence the infrastructure and investment decisions that are made today will still make sense decades from now. So preparedness is no longer only about responding after a disaster happened. It is really increasingly about long-term planning, smarter infrastructure investment, and reducing future cost before the crisis occur. And I think that community increasingly understand that, especially here in Tasman. Everybody still really understand this. What people want in this moment, I believe, is practical answers, leadership, and honest conversation, and pretty much a steady long-term planning.
A recent coverage by Newsroom about the Climate Commission's risk assessment quotes Dame Patsy Reddy, who's the chair, and she wrote, "New Zealand can't focus everywhere at once. And the climate change makes decisions more complex, but it also sharpens priorities. This is a moment for leadership," so taking up on your point there, "and where clear sequencing and sustained focus matter more than attempting to do everything at once." At a local level then, what does that mean?
I think that Dame Patsy's Reddy is right. Climate change forces the need for clearer priorities that we need to have and clearly decide on what and what not to do with the finances that we do have. Councils in general cannot do everything at once. We don't have that kind of financial strength to do so. And local government works with real world limits around budgets, infrastructure cycles, and affordability for ratepayers. So leadership at a local level, in my opinion, means sequencing decisions carefully, focusing investment where it has greatest long-term benefit, and reducing larger future costs. What that means asking the following questions. Where are the highest risks for us in our region? Which infrastructure is most critical? And where early action can make the biggest difference? Climate change makes decision even more complex, because before we were used to think linearly, but it also, climate change allows us to sharpen our focus. So for example, where infrastructure faces repeated flooding or coastal risk, council need to assess whether to protect that structure, adapt, redesign, or gradually transition over time. Those are specifically difficult conversations, but delay them usually has proven to increase costs and uncertainty later, both for institutions and for communities. For Tasman, the key would be balancing resilience, affordability, fairness for ratepayers. Residents want decisions that are practical and transparent, that are actually evidence-based and focus on long-term community benefits. So that from experience and from international experience, good climate leadership is often less about dramatic announcements and more about steady progress. Improving infrastructure planning, working very closely with the community at IWI, and building resilience step by step. And this is simply because resilience is built over decades and not election cycles.
As we were talking there, I was thinking that we are going to look at we have the potential to have a real economic boom in a way, as building occurs and, you know, engineering and all this kind of stuff works. Is it fair to say we have a thing called the adaptation economy?
It's a very useful starting point, because climate adaptation is becoming not only a challenge, but also a major area of investment, innovation, and economic change. Around the world, we are seeing investment around resilient infrastructure, water systems, flood protection, climate smart designs. But I personally think that we should go one step further and think about building a resilience economy. Adaptation can sometimes sound very reactive, and this has been proven internationally. Responding to damage or retreating or relocating from risk, resilience is far more forward-looking. It is about creating communities that can continue to thrive under changing conditions. And that's really what climate change is about. And importantly, the legal and policy environment, our legal and policy environment, is really changing very quickly, nationally, but also internationally. Councils will need to stay flexible, will need to think innovatively, and ready to adapt as the frameworks evolve. International best practice increasingly focuses on resilience, through smarter infrastructure, nature-based solution, and long-term planning. This is a different way of thinking altogether. For Tasman, this could mean stronger infrastructure, smart land use planning, climate-smart agriculture and horticulture, and the possibility of creating new jobs linked to resilience and sustainability. So the opportunity is not only on managing climate risks. And that's what we are here in New Zealand at this point in time in history. It is really building communities that are meaningfully more adaptable, more resilient, and better prepared for the future. And I think that our Tasman residents respond positively when climate and conversation focus not only on risk, but also on practical opportunity and long-term value for the community, like, you know, whether that is a resilient type of economy where every person within this district and within Aotearoa New Zealand more broader would benefit from.
So the thing is, we're standing at a moment where we can open the door on the resilience economy.
Absolutely. And I think this is, like everything, this is a moment where we can choose to go either ways, but there is an incredible opportunity for our residents, for the way that we want to design our future together.
Barbara Lewindo, our Senior Climate Change Policy Advisor, taking us through impact data from natural events and our approach to understanding them in the Tasman context. Now, with that in mind, a few weeks back in Golden Bay, Mohua 2042 hosted a Resilience Expo, which was well attended with great displays and standing room only presentations. I asked Andrew Hayes, coordinator for Mohua 2042, about the level of awareness in the Bay around preparedness for natural events.
Because the residents are quite used to the hill closing, there is an awareness that that happens regularly, so people need to be ready.
So do you think people who were attending got a good picture of what has been established, but also the opportunity going forward?
I think as well, just pulling people together in their communities. You know, there's a lot of people that, you know, live on streets with neighbours, and they don't really know their neighbours very well. And I think this has kind of prompted people to reconsider the importance of knowing their neighbours and knowing their community in these types of events.
Just before we let you go, Mohua 2042, give us a lowdown. What is that? What's the vision behind that?
So Mohua 2042 was born out of a strategy that was developed with the community and by the community. There was a group that got together to think about, well, what is the vision of what we want from our area in the next 20 years? What is important to us in the Bay? And sustainability was a big driving force of that. And one of the outcomes of sustainability is a resiliency as well. So, you know, we can be self-sufficient. And so this was a strategy that was pulled together 4 years ago. And then the trust was formed to basically find lots of different ways to help bring that strategy to life. And so as an organization, it's a networking and supporting umbrella organization. So a lot of what the trust does is supporting smaller initiatives and events and groups in the Bay that all are working towards different aspects of community resiliency and sustainability. So helping these groups get connected in with funding and grants that they might not otherwise be eligible to apply for because they don't have charitable status. We're providing coaching and mentoring for various groups who have maybe received funding and need support in, you know, pulling together budgets and schedules. We're a connecting organisation as well. So just trying to empower people with the strategies and ideas that they're bringing to the Bay.
Coordinator for Mohua 2042, Andrew Hayes. And that's a wrap. Music credits to Mr. Washington and Contra. I'm John Bullock, and this show, Tasman Report, is a production of the Tasman District Council.
The podcast you just listened to was first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community Access Media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz.